I'm Mark Ryberg, a principal in the Physician Workforce Practice at Sullivan Cotter, and I'll serve as the moderator for today's webinar. Sullivan Cotter provides industry expertise, regulatory insight, and market-leading physician compensation data to help our clients mitigate risk through an array of comprehensive fair market value and commercial reasonableness assessments and advisory support. We are proud to be sponsoring today's podcast. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to our two panelists, Bob Homchick from Davis Wright and Tremaine, and Julie Cass from Baker Donaldson. Robert, I'll turn it over to you to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mark. I'm a healthcare regulatory lawyer at Davis Wright, based in Seattle. My co-presenter, Julie Cass, is also a healthcare regulatory lawyer at Baker Ober, and based in Baltimore. We both have, I think, between us, a fair amount of experience in advising clients around the nuances of the Stark Law and anti-kickback statute, and participated in the webinar a couple weeks ago with CMS and OIG around the Sprint regulations. What we're hoping to do today is cover kind of a range of topics that were raised as questions during that webinar and that otherwise have presented themselves to us or to other people at the American Health Lawyers Association. Julie, do you have anything you want to add as a preamble?
No, Bob, thanks. I think you've covered it. We're going to try and get to those issues where we think that there's some interesting things in the regs, both, as you said, from questions that came up on the webinar, as well as things that we've been informally batting around. So we'll bring that informal discussion to everybody listening to the podcast.
So we were going to start with looking at the value-based exceptions, value-based enterprise, and look at some of the distinctions between CMS's proposed Stark exceptions that focus in this area and the OIG's proposed safe harbors. The first issue I was going to take is who is eligible, and both CMS and OIG proposals define a value-based participant as an individual or entity that engages in at least one value-based activity as a part of a value-based enterprise. As you might guess, each of those value-based terms has its own definition, but in the OIG's safe harbor definition, certain folks are excluded from the definition of value-based participant. That includes pharmaceutical manufacturers, distributors, and suppliers of DME, prosthetics, orthotics, supplies, and laboratories, clinical laboratories. So those categories cannot be value-based participants under the safe harbor, but they can be value-based participants under the Stark exception. So there's, as we'll see, there's some notable distinctions between CMS's approach and the OIG's approach. In addition, the OIG is considering excluding pharmacy benefit managers, wholesalers, distributors of pharmaceutical products, and certain device manufacturers. CMS, you know, throws out some commentary on these issues, but as I said, the baseline is CMS is sort of letting all players qualify as potential value-based participants, whereas OIG is taking a more limited view.
And Julie? Bob, when we're looking at this, it seems to be sort of a theme of these two regulations together that CMS is or OIG is a little bit more conservative on purpose than CMS in some of these rules. CMS saying, you know, we are a payment rule and OIG being a stopgap measure. I think this is one of those areas. You know, why do you think that OIG is really taking the position that they have to exclude these individuals, whereas CMS, not so sure?
Well, I think you're right that CMS took a more liberal view, and it's a payment rule, and they're going to allow more on that initial threshold. No, and OIG views its role as, well, you may get away with it under Stark if we really see some abuse, some bad activity with the wrong intent. We're going to retain our ability to intervene and stop the activity. So I think you put it once, we need to be comfortable being uncomfortable, that you can fit within a stark exception, you can qualify as a value-based participant under stark and still have potential exposure under the anti-kickback statute. So the OIG views itself as the cop and CMS more as fit within the four corners of the stark exception and you're good to go.
I think that's right, Bob. I think that's right. With that in mind and looking at just the differences between these two sets of value-based rules, clearly the OIG and CMS have talked to one another about them. They didn't create them in isolation from each other. They review each other's rules. And clearly there are things that are the same. There are three rules that each has. You know, full risk, some kind of partial risk, and some kind of potentially no risk. One is in descending order, the other is in ascending order, but then there are a lot of differences that are fairly meaningful and that folks might want to comment on. The one thing that I want to pick up in this part is really the difference of the proposed definitions in what I would say the medium category in these value-based rules, which is the from the CMS side, what they call the meaningful downside financial risk exception. And on the OIG side, it's a substantial downside financial risk. Like I said, you know, presumably they each have three. This one's in the middle, but I would have people really look at these because the way you measure the risk in either of these is very different. It's not just the number, 50% risk versus 60 or 80% risk, but really the way they calculate the risk. And so while I think that the OIG and CMS have done a really good job of being coordinated in a lot of ways, this could cause some confusion if you want to meet both a stark exception and an anti-kickback safe harbor to have to, you're not full risk and you're not no risk, but you're somewhere in the middle. You know, folks are really going to have to look at the way these are structured now that they meet both of those requirements. Meaningful downside risk to a physician from the stark side is the physician is responsible to pay an entity no less than 25% of the value of the remuneration under the value-based arrangement, or is financially responsible to the entity on a prospective basis for the cost of all or a defined set of patient care covered by the payer for each patient in the target population. So you've got this 25% rule. It goes back to physician incentive plan rules under the stark rules that are already there. But under the kickback statute, the substantial downside financial risk has four different ways you can meet it. There have to be, you know, there could be a shared savings with a repayment obligation to a payer of at least 40% of shared losses. There can be a repayment obligation to the payer where there's an episode or a bundled payment of at least 20% of any loss. And there's, you know, others, the prospectively paid population payment for a defined subset of the total cost of care of a target patient population. You know, or if you don't have data, evidence-based comparable expenditures, or they even give you a fourth way to come within substantial downside financial risk, a partially capitated payment from a payer for a set of items or services for a target patient population where that capitated payment is a discount of at least 60% of the total expected fee for service. So four different ways to calculate under OIG, a couple different ways under CMS. So folks are going to have to carefully pay attention to where they are, which they can meet, and know that they'll have to meet potentially different requirements to fit in both the stark and the kickback statute. And then the only other thing that I would add is both of them talk about downside financial risk. And I think it would be helpful when the final rules come out for CMS and OIG to really comment on what downside risk is. Bob, you and I have talked a bunch about if it's a bonus, if you have a cap and you can get a bonus if you do quality, is that downside risk? Because if you don't do those things, you don't get the bonus, or would the government consider that only upside risk? And why wouldn't you want to count that?
Right. I actually think this is an area where some simplicity or simplification would be wonderful. This is too confusing for, you know, for the average person to embrace. And I think OIG in particular here probably made this more complicated than it should be. At least that's my opinion on it. I think they were trying to think of the various ways in which risk could be assumed. Both because they've created a different standard from CMS and because they went into all these different variations on a theme, made it a pretty complicated calculation. The other thing is, I think the PIP regs, physician incentive plan regs, talk about the amount at risk, where you look at total potential payment to a physician, and that should be the way that downside risk is measured. That as you put money at risk, whether it's in a bonus or whatever, that's downside risk. If you have the potential to earn $100 and you don't earn it because you fail, that's downside risk, in my opinion. At least I'd hope that's the direction that both of the agencies take.
And certainly they don't preclude that right now in the proposed rules. It's just not clear how they would think about that at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree. I wanted to move on to what I call the third exception under the value-based third exception safe harbor. Under CMS, it's a value-based arrangement that really has no risk-sharing requirement or threshold. CMS, this is a pretty broad exception and allows for, notably, for payment of cash. The hospital or other participants in a value-based enterprise can pay physicians for engaging in value-based activities, no fair market value requirement, notably. When you turn to the OIG, it's really a care coordination and management safe harbor. And under that safe harbor, it's limited to an in-kind exchange. So you can't write a check, but you can provide services between and among the various folks involved in the delivery of care.
And certainly, I think this is one of those areas where they're showing the difference between what these two rules are about, CMS being, again, as we talked about earlier, that payment rule, and the OIG really being that stopgap. They're falling back on the same kind of rules they did on the EHR donation, where there's no cash involved. It all has to be an in-kind. You can be a hospital and put a person in the nursing home to track those patients that may be coming back to you to make sure that they're not readmitted. And then in addition to that, that nursing home would have to pay 15%. They have to have some stake in it to make sure it's real. So a real difference there. And in one of those places where you may feel comfortable that you get there on the Stark side, but what happens on a kickback kind of side? In other areas, I think you'd want to be, there are things that Stark allows that the kickback statute just wouldn't in its exception. One of my favorite examples from these regs is in order to align physicians' practices with a protocol, the regs allow, and the example allows the hospital to pay physicians $10 for each instance that they order a dual modality screening as opposed to a single modality screening during a 2-year period to look at the protocol. So that's actual cash that a hospital could pay to a physician to get up to speed with
order
the protocol,
more.
But that's for ordering a test, right? For that referral, for that test. And certainly that's not covered under the kickback statute safe harbor. But
no,
it
I
does
agree.
Have a purpose.
Well, the OIG, in all of its value-based exceptions, really is very focused on this concept of coordination and management of care. which it talks about being the deliberate organization of patient care activities and sharing information between two participants tailored to improving outcomes of the target patient population and so forth. And it is interesting how thematic the OIG is, particularly given that CMS seems to sort of ignore that standard. They don't really embrace it. And it's certainly, there's no definition, and it's not a theme within either the CMS actual regulatory text or in the commentary for under the STARC proposals, which is a distinction that I think is maybe noteworthy, but I find it a little disconcerting that the two agencies seem to be focusing on different things when it comes to how they view what is value-based.
Although the definitions are seemingly very similar in that aspect. Maybe we could move on now to another area where I know you and I have gotten a lot of questions. When we're having payments to doctors, we always look at what's the fair market value payment, how much should you compensate a physician? And Bob, I'm interested in your thoughts about, can you pay additional compensation to an employed physician who's engaged in these value-based activities if that would take it above what we would traditionally say is fair market value?
I think this is an area where there's going to a lot of ink will be spilled, let's put it that way. It's noteworthy that none of the VBE exceptions include a fair market value requirement. And we talked about the rationale behind that, and I think that's appropriate, and I'm glad that the agencies embraced that perspective. But we all know that STARC and anti-kickback aren't the only regulatory requirements where fair market value is relevant. If you're a nonprofit or a state agency or somewhat, you still need to consider whether or not the arrangement is in between a physician or between other value-based participants and the exempt or state entity is fair market value. So you can't just give it a back of the hand. The other thing is that I would submit that the value-based activity changes the calculus. The premise is that you're paying for value, you are paying for something different, something over and above just the delivery of the services. So I would question the premise of, are you really above fair market value when you are paying a physician additional sums or another for engaging the value-based activity and getting those value-based results? Note that the survey data, generally the salary survey data for physicians, MGMA and Sullivan-Cotter and the like, generally doesn't take into account value-based activities. So I think there's room to argue, but here I'm going to turn to Mark, because at the end of the day, I'm a lawyer. I don't opine as to fair market value. I have to kind of know my way around a bit, but I'm going to be turning to people like Mark and his firm, and I'm kind of curious what he has to say on this.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, I might have to disagree on one aspect of your recent commentary. As a firm, we have generally taken a pretty active approach to try and compile and or collect these value-based payments and reflect those in the total cash compensation that we're reporting in the survey data. I would agree with you. How successful we are in that regard. It's a bit challenging because these pay practices are changing. They're changing pretty rapidly, and folks' compliance with survey submissions is a different issue altogether. But our intent is very much to be capturing that data. And as we see more emphasis put on these other value-based payments, we think it's going to be absolutely critical that we can speak to pay practices. What proportion of total cash compensation is production-driven? What proportion is coming in through some alternative value-based payment mechanism. So we will be tracking that. We will be reporting it. And I do think you're correct in your original statement that I think this changes the calculus a bit. We've historically used fairly bright line standards firm to firm around what we consider to be fair market value. And we may apply those old rubric and find that total cash compensation inclusive of a new value-based payment made under one of these exceptions might push us outside of the traditional market norms. And I think the introduction of these new quality payments, I think your commentary about what are we really paying for, these are we're paying relative to qualitative performance standards, and therefore it is potentially above and beyond, or it is a separate payment recognizing a separate distinct service that in effect is not related to the volume or value of referrals, is a very advantageous fact. So what I think will end up happening is the firms out there that are doing these analyses will probably hedge on the conservative side and be including these payments in their fair market value analysis. But I do think we're going to have a little more freedom and a little more flexibility in arguing that there are facts and circumstances that might take us outside of the traditional norms that we've used when comparing physicians to market.
This is not going to be your mother's WRVUs any longer. Thanks.
Correct.
Wait and see what happens, but more changes to come. You know, one of the interesting things with all these, you know, three new exceptions on either side is, you know, seemingly the CMS models that have come out previously from CMMI that have had waivers, as well as the Medicare Shared Savings Program for ACOs that actually waive Stark and kickback, et cetera. While those waivers may stay in place for the programs that are there, I think the idea is there's not going to be these waivers anymore, where we might not have had to think about these fair market value issues of how you pay compensation to physicians because the rules would have just been waived. It was, if you met those criteria, it was fairly clear you didn't need to consider that for Stark and kickback purposes anymore. You know, CMS, OIG, interestingly enough, has a safe harbor that says if you have a CMS-sponsored model and meet very high-level criteria, only a few, that the kickback statute wouldn't be implicated. So you get a safe harbor if you're in a CMS-sponsored model. Interestingly enough, there is not the same exception on the CMS Stark side. Commentary in the rules says, well, we don't really believe we need a Stark exception because you'd be able to fit in one of the three value-based exceptions that we've just created. So fit in one of those, you don't need a fourth exception. I don't know your opinion, Bob.
It seems
it would be easier if it's a CMS model for CMS to have created a parallel exception to the safe harbor for consistency and ease of those people that are already being governed by those rules in the CMS sponsored model. Bob?
Yeah, I think there is no way that these three value-based exceptions that CMS has proposed for Stark are equivalent to the waiver under the MSSP program, for example. That is just completely different. And I think as CMS starts to experiment with different models in different contexts, it will find that these the proposed exceptions are not flexible enough to allow participants to really do what they need to do under the various models. So I think that CMS should follow suit with OIG and say, if we've created a model, you're going to have and you follow the rules of that model, that you're within an exception. So it seems to me to be a trap for the unwary, perhaps, under some of the CMS models, where the Stark exceptions will not be adequately flexible. So, Julie, I had a question for you about value-based purpose, which is, you know, defined by similarly by both OIG and CMS. But let's say take a typical gain sharing program. Physician saves a hospital money on a DME implant or, you know, some sort of implant. Does that qualify as a value-based purpose?
So I would argue that those kinds of gain sharing plans should qualify as a value-based purpose. You know, you and I have had a lot of discussions on this because of the way it's actually defined in the regulation that specifically talks about cost savings for payers. but doesn't really then say, or hospitals. And as we know, a lot of the gain sharing payments are savings that hospitals have from, you know, using certain protocols. But, and so that has created some lack of clarity there, but I would suggest that there are a couple of places in the preamble, including one that I think is pretty clear, that talks about value-based arrangements, including performance and quality standards that relate to remuneration. And they give an example that says, for example, an arrangement to share the internal cost savings achieved if a physician meaningfully participates in a hospital's quality and outcomes improvement program and reaches or exceeds predetermined benchmarks for their performance, that would be okay. That was given as a positive example of how this would work. And so I think it's interesting, while the regulation itself would seem to perhaps preclude payment where it's not savings from a payer, but rather the hospital's getting that savings, this example that's in the preamble that talks specifically about what we would normally call the, you know, short term, we would call it gain sharing, seems to be contemplated by CMS in its regulation and given a stamp of approval, but perhaps something that they should make clear in the final rule.
It would certainly seem to be an appropriate clarification of the definition of value-based purpose in light of the commentary that you point out, because I do think that the definition itself is at best confusing on this point.
And if you look back over time, I mean, CMS generally hasn't had a negative reaction to gain sharing issues. They've tried to put out previous proposed regulations. They've not come out with final, but it wasn't because they thought that they were so abusive. You don't have that language. It's, we didn't really think that we got it right, and we think that you could probably protect in different ways gain sharing arrangements perhaps already in some of the current exceptions. So to me, CMS has never come out and said we have issues with gain sharing because we think they're abusive, thus we don't want to protect them. It's been contrary to that, and they've wanted to do it in some way. They just didn't have what they thought was the appropriate vehicle to or need to do a gain sharing exception. So to me, that background, along with this preamble discussion, leads me to believe that they really do intend to protect those things.
I think you're right. I hope you're right. Let's put it that way.
So, Bob, if we transition slightly from the value-based exceptions and look at the other part of the rule that that CMS did, at least. They tried to do some technical changes to some definitions, and one that sort of bridges the gap between value-based things and changing definitions is some commentary they have about changing the indirect exception and how the risk-sharing exception works in that I think creates potentially some confusion in their change with respect to how you use the risk sharing exception now and whether you can, you know, couch it as part of the indirect compensation exception. Do you want to talk a little bit about that discussion that we've been having?
I don't know if this was intentional or not, bluntly, but one of the things that CMS has said sort of in commentary, but never really in the reg itself, is that once you have an indirect financial relationship with the three-part test and everything else, then the exceptions available are the indirect compensation exception and the global or service-based exception, prepaid plan, in-office ancillary, that sort. Well, they now have proposed to put that in the regulatory text, and this is the Sprint rules, you know, they made a sort of big deal at the front that we have the risk sharing exception, we have these other exceptions under Stark, and nothing we're doing in this is designed to limit or take away anything from your ability to use those exceptions. But if it's true that the risk sharing exception can't be used for indirect arrangements, that's a significant limitation. And if you look at the language of the exception itself and the related commentary around the way managed care organization and everything else and some of the other key terms are defined, it clearly contemplates indirect relationships and that the risk-sharing exception would apply to those. So here's, kind of my pitch to CMS to, maybe clean this up, that, if you have an indirect relationship, you can still rely on the risk-sharing exception as, and that we didn't intend to narrow it through this rulemaking.
I think that's right. So as we progress, again, moving away from value-based even further, I think one of the most welcomed exceptions is exception Z. I love the fact that the exception is exception Z, and this is for the ability to pay a physician under the Stark exception $3,500 per year with no writing, no signature, no set in advance. Obviously, it still has to be fair market value, can't be based on the volume or value of referrals. It has to be commercially reasonable. But this opens up a big area where there are technical, what I would call a technical violation, where someone was paid for something, they did the service, it was meaningful, it was necessary, you didn't pay them too much, but you just didn't paper it. And so I think exception Z is going to be a really great thing. Go ahead, Bob.
Operationally, I think this is going to be wonderful. The administrator on call realizes that they need, coverage for some particular subspecialty. For whatever reason, they have a shortage. They turn to a member of their medical staff and say, yes, I'll pay you $500. We don't want to go on diversion and we have a real need. That sort of thing that happens in real time, the ability to get a writing together in time to make that happen is truly a challenge. And this creates the ability to deal with those. And moreover, CMS in the commentary explicitly stated it creates this sort of grace period when you start something and you jump the gun, where I start a relationship or a medical directorship. And I don't have the documentation in place. I haven't reduced it to writing. I don't have a signature. And it goes on 2 or 3 months. Well, if over those 2 or 3 months, I paid less than $3,500, $3,500 or less, then I can paper it. And the first 3 months fall under exception Z. And the rest of the term can fall under fair market value arrangement exception or one of the other exceptions that requires a writing because I had time to get it in place. So I think this really will clear out what I would call the underbrush, the silly, it was fine. We were paying fair market value. We were doing the right thing, but we just didn't get our act together from a sort of writing signature and process standpoint.
And I think, Bob, what's interesting to me is they haven't limited this to emergency situations. I know I have clients that come and they actually have a writing and they have a group that was providing some service to the hospital. And then it was growing great and they added another service. And then we sit there, we're like, well, is this additional service part of what you specified in the first contract, or is it really additional and you're paying them additional money, which is what usually happens, but you didn't paper that next bit because it was just sort of organic that the next piece of the service came along and you didn't think to go back and actually paper that. And again, even though that wasn't an emergent situation, up to $3,500, you can pay that amount. So you catch it and you're like, well, how much did we pay so far? Okay, we paid $4,000, but wait a minute, it's been over 4 months. We take the $3,500 and you can do this now. In the preamble, it specifically says this. You look at the $3,500, you put that aside and you start counting from the $3,501. And now they've also given you 90 days, not just to get the signature, but to get a writing in place, which gives you $3,500 plus 90 days. to actually then put pen to paper, get it done. Obviously, you've had to have the amount already, but it really will, I think you put it well, clear out that underbrush of things where there was really no risk. And I think that's what Stark is trying to do. In the preamble, they said they've had voluminous amounts of self-disclosures, most of which needed to be self-disclosed, and most of which had no risk of fraud or abuse.
Right.
And so I think that's really what these rules are trying to address, and in a very good way.
Yeah, I agree with you. This combination of exception Z, the 90-day grace period for writing and signatures, there's a lot of flexibility built in there. And you can think of variations on a theme on ways that you can use each of those elements. One question is, the per physician or the $3,500, is it per physician or per group?
I don't think they specifically address that. I would advocate that it's per physician, not having it said per group, and that it's really each time you have a physician. Having said that, if your arrangement, the financial arrangement is between the group, that may be a different story. So probably more to come on that.
The other thing I've heard people talk about is, non-monetary compensation. We have a number of our clients who their compliance programs include a tracking mechanism. I don't think exception Z should trigger that same sort of infrastructure. Seems to me that exception Z is, if you know about an arrangement, go ahead and put it in writing, because there's no sense just saying, well, it's only $100 a month, so we don't need anything as long as it's fair market value. While it may be true, I think you want to save that $3,500 for the ones where you need it. And when you're walking in and know that I'm going to hire this guy, I'm going to pay him $100, $200 a month to do X or Y, go ahead and put that in writing. And don't encourage, or I wouldn't advise establishing any sort of tracking system around this $3,500 per physician around the exception Z infrastructure.
Well, I agree with you that if you have the 90 days and you can set it out in writing, you absolutely should do that and save your $3,500 for where that writing exception is not available. I do think it could be helpful in some cases if you have instances where it's, you're paying $100 here, $1,000 there. At the end of the day, there could be some circumstances where you have no idea how much you've paid the physician and whether you've gone over that limit, because it doesn't have to be $3,500 for one particular kind of service. Over a year, you could have a dinner that wasn't covered, or you could have a whole bunch of different things, and you won't know how much, or you'll have to do a lot of historical digging that may be difficult. I know some of my clients have difficulty going backwards to figure out, well, did we have a problem? Don't we have a problem? So it might be useful on the front end to set up if you're going to use that exception, right? You don't need a $3,500 Z log per se, but if you find that you are going to use that exception, that you somehow document it and keep track of it for however much of the $3,500 you've used.
That I agree with. That once you know you have taken advantage of it because, I did this coverage agreement on an emergency basis, so I paid this guy $1,000 over the course of, a few days, and I didn't document it. So there's $1,000 in his Z account. That makes sense to me. I just don't think that people should intentionally use this. Save it for when you need it is my advice. And if you know what's coming and have time and can take advantage of the other exceptions, definitely do it.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely. Well, I think our podcast time may be up. I will turn it back to see if there's any final words.
Julie, thanks. I greatly appreciate the time that you and Bob put into today's podcast and the tremendous insights that you offered. I'm sure many questions will follow. But with that, we'll wrap it up and we'll talk again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.